On behalf of Don's family, I want to welcome everybody here for the last quarter century or so. I've been privileged to know Don and his family, and I've been included in a number of the significant events that and ceremonies in that family's life, and this is a big one, a real big one. Today we're gathered to celebrate a life well-lived and a life well-remembered. One thing that I've learned over the years is that the earth has a shortage of real characters. And we have one less today. So we need to take some time to remember the tracks that Don Brown left on our memories, in our memories, and on our hearts. So we will review that and celebrate his life and the things that he meant to all of us gathered here today. He was born on a farm near Riparia, Washington. Riparia is not a, is that, did I pronounce it right? Yeah, I thought so, but it's not like a metropolis or anything like that. In fact, it doesn't exist anymore, I don't think, except in little tracks. And on December 13th of 1916, and he passed away on April 14th, following a long struggle with Parkinson's disease. He grew up on a wheat farm. He was raised by his parents, Ida and J.M. Brown, who were assisted in the task of raising him by ten other siblings who were part of the sort of group that did this for Don. The work on the farm, at that farm at the time, was done largely by horses and men and women and kids. And Don graduated from Montesano High School. He worked to secure a business degree from the University of Washington, and he served in the Navy during World War II on Kodiak Island in Alaska. And I challenge anybody that hasn't known Don for 70 years to identify, to pick this man out of a lineup somewhere who's shown in your picture. I didn't ever know Don looking like that, but what a great photo that is of him. Following the war, he owned and operated a camera repair business, Phototronics, before retiring. He spent many years as a retiree. All the years that I knew Don, he was retired. He enjoyed every one of those years, living on the shores of Holler Lake and visiting Hawaii every year. He enjoyed his many friends, his extensive family, hard work, gardening, canoe trips, telling stories. Some of you know that some of those stories were perhaps of questionable taste, and playing practical jokes on just about everybody. He was a mainstay at Holler Lake Community Club, was passionate about neighborhood issues for more than 50 years. He's survived by his lovely and talented wife, Phyllis, his older brother, Clyde. He had five children, Jerry, Kathy, Patty, Brenda, and Bruce. Sons-in-law, Steve, Mike, Dean, and daughter-in-law, Carol. Six grandchildren, nine great-grandchildren, seven step-great-grandchildren, or grandchildren, and 12 step-great-grandchildren. In other words, too numerous to mention by name here today, but a very large extended family. And a large number of friends, as evidenced by your attendance here today. And also among this caregiver, the survivors were his caregivers, Linda Schumann, Bayou Gazan, Malika Vitutu, and the team, the other folks that helped take care of Don. So I'm going to ask you to join me this morning in reciting David's prayer, the 23rd Psalm, together. It's printed in your program, so if you would join me in reciting that. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. He maketh me to lie down in green pastures. He leadeth me beside the still waters. He restoreth my soul. He leadeth me in the paths of righteousness for his name's sake. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Thy rod and thy staff, they comfort me. Thou preparest a table before me in the presence of mine enemies. Thou anointest my head with oil, my cup runneth over. Surely goodness and mercy shall follow me all the days of my life, and I will dwell in the house of the Lord forever. I can direct your attention to the screen in the front. We have a short video presentation. Thank you.
Well, on behalf of the family, I'd like to add my thanks to all of you for being here today to honor Don. The support the family's gotten the last few weeks and frankly the last few years from all of you has really helped everybody. It was certainly meant a lot to Don, and it meant a lot to the family. Yeah, I want to particularly thank his caregivers during the past couple of years, and I know some of them are here, Bio and Nolini and Linda and Malika, and a lot of Malika's team, and I'm afraid I don't have all the names, and I apologize, but having these wonderful people there, I mean, it was wonderful for Don, but it was wonderful for the family, too. The support they gave and the comfort we received knowing that they were there really helped these last few years. I also want to acknowledge the solo of Steve Tatchell and his accompanying us. They're kind of up where you can't see him in the balcony, but Steve has been a family friend since he and Kath sang in their high school choir several years ago. Don was really a special person, as all of you who had the privilege of knowing him know. He, as I always told him, was my favorite father-in-law. He was a husband, a father, and he was just a solid, hard-working guy. And I think Lynn alluded to the fact that he was a character with all the positive connotations that carries with it. And over the many years that I knew him, I became convinced that much of the character that we knew and loved about Don was really forged many years ago as a child on that wheat farm in the Palouse that you saw pictures of in the slide there, because those were the early years, and frankly, they were pretty tough years, and many of the characteristics that we really loved about Don came from those early years. The Palouse wheat farm, the Palouse country is beautiful country. There were several photos of it with the rolling wheat fields. Photographers love it because it is so pretty. It's crummy land to farm. It's steep hills and valleys, and when you think that they were doing their farming with horses, not with tractors, it was just a lot of work. Sometimes the combines, I think, would have 20 or more horses hitched to them, and so it was tough country. His father was made for that kind of country. He was a tough, hard guy too, but he wasn't a particularly charming or loving guy from all accounts, and he almost viewed his kids more as farmhands than as loving children, and he very much subscribed to the spare the rod, spoil the child line of thinking. His mother, who passed away when Don was just 12, was, I think, a much more loving, compassionate person, and his sense of humor, I think, even surfaced in those early years with his mother. He told of stealing donuts from the back of the wood stove when she would bake and put them up there to cool. He would sneak in with a broom handle and pilfer donuts when she wasn't looking. So that's a characteristic that started early for Don. He was raised very much off the grid, we would say now, but there wasn't a grid in those days to be off of. But for power, well, they didn't have power. For lighting, though, they used kerosene lanterns, like the kind you see in the cowboy movies. And for heat, it was the wood stove in the kitchen. And, of course, the cooking was all done in the wood stove. To show everything they did was hard, and just to heat that stove meant they had to get firewood. To get the firewood, they had to hitch 6 horses to the wagon, go down a rather steep hill to the Snake River, which was nearby, drag driftwood off the beach, load it in the wagon, haul it up to the home. The young kids, Don, the smaller kids, would cut that with a cross-cut saw, not a chainsaw, split it to wood box length, and that's what kept their stove going all winter long, and that was the primary heat for the house. I don't mean to disparage the farm, but it was a crummy place. I mean, they didn't even have enough water for the livestock and the family, so they had to load a water tank on a wagon and go to a neighboring farm to get much of their water supply. So everything they did was work. Because Don was small and because he was one of the younger kids, he tended to get the jobs that he could do. He couldn't handle a team of horses out in the field. So he ended up taking care of the horses at the end of the day after the horses were brought in. The little kids ended up dealing with the horses. He and his sister and brothers, the smaller brothers, would deal with the dairy cattle and the chickens and any other livestock around the home. In the summer during harvest, no one was exempt. All 11 kids were involved somehow. And Don talked of standing on the side of the combine. They would load the wheat into bags in those days rather than a truck, and he would be responsible for stitching those bags closed by hand and doing it fast enough so when the next bag was done, he was ready to go to work. It was a lot of work, bottom line, it was a lot of work. But that's the way Don was his entire life. He was never afraid to do a lot of work. His teenage years were spent during the Depression, and one of the icons of the Depression were hobos, people that rode the rails, you know, the bums, as we would call them. And I didn't realize till later on that my father-in-law was a bum. He was a hobo, because when they wanted to get around Eastern Washington, they didn't have a car. They just rode the rails. And there were lots of trains running around the country in those days, but when there was fruit to pick up by Spokane, they'd hop a freight and go up to Spokane. When they wanted to come to Montesano to visit their sister, they hopped a freight and headed west. And it wasn't a direct line. They might end up in Portland or Seattle, but they would get there. So my father-in-law was a hobo at times. I think a lot of his likes and dislikes really later in life came from that early experience. Horses, for example, which his daughter Patty loved her entire life to this day, he didn't care much for, because for him they were just a lot of work. And they were animals you used to plow the fields. And so pets, they were not to Don, and he never liked horses. He didn't like cold. Eastern Washington in those days, well, now too, it's cold in the winter, but their house was not well insulated. The only heat was the wood stove. And the winters were long and cold. And he told stories of taking his blanket down and crawling in behind the wood stove at night to soak up the heat that was still radiating from the stove at the end of the day, just trying to stay warm. He never liked the cold, but on the other hand, he loved warmth. He loved to be warm, and he loved the Eastern Washington weather. And he went on many canoe trips to Eastern Washington, to the Potholes Reservoir and Winchester Wasteway, over on this side of the mountains. After a hard day in his garden, he would love to lay out in the sun and fall asleep. He could sleep anywhere. That's one reason they went to Hawaii every fall. He just loved the warmth. They'd spend 2 months in Hawaii for probably 20 years or more. And Phyllis would go swim laps down the ocean, and he'd lay in the sun and just soak it in. And when he did come home, he'd keep the fireplace going in the sun porch almost constantly, and you'd often go in there and find him asleep on the hard floor in front of the fireplace, but he was warm. I think he actually developed his sense of humor and his practical, joking nature on the farm. And even though it was harsh living, those brothers found ways to have fun and to play tricks on one another. And we would see that at the Brown reunions, which we had every year. You'd get these brothers together, and they would tell stories about practical jokes and tricks that they played on people, and then just plain tell jokes all the time. Poor Phyllis got so tired of them, I think she'd go crazy at some of those reunions. But he had his sense of humor. He was never adverse to hard work. There was no job he wouldn't tackle. The guy, and to the end, you almost had to strap him down to keep him from doing things that he shouldn't be doing later in his life. And he had a love for gardening, which was interesting to me, because he didn't want to be a farmer. He very much didn't want to be a farmer, but he loved the garden, and he would spend hours out in his vegetable garden and working with Phyllis in their gardens. So there was something that stayed with him. Well, when it came time for high school, it wasn't clear that he'd be able to finish on the farm. His dad wasn't really supportive of higher education. So Don left and went to Montesano to live with his older sister. And Brownie helped him through high school, and then he went from there up to the University of Washington, where he got his business degree, and parenthetically happened to meet Phyllis Faroe, but apparently there were no flames or sparks that were lit at that time, and they parted company. He then went, as Lynn said, to Kodiak, where he worked with the Navy from about 1940 to 1943. And it was interesting. He formed some friendships up there that he stayed with him his entire life. His Kodiak friends were very dear to him. They'd get together, and kind of like the Brown reunion, the guys would be telling stories about the good old days up in Kodiak, which wasn't at the end of the earth in those days, but it was pretty near the end of the earth for a 20-year-old guy who's out there for three or more years. He was the last of the Kodiak guys to go. All of his friends predeceased him. But we got a nice note from the daughters of Larry Gorley, one of the last men to go, and she says, "Well, our dads are together again, and they're up to something by now, I'm sure." And that's probably true. Well, in 43, he made it back. He crewed on a ship that came back to Seattle, and he went to call on Phyllis. And sparks did light that time, and they started a 65-year journey through life together and had a wonderful life and have raised some wonderful kids. The last few years have been a challenge for Don physically as Parkinson's began taking a toll and beginning to restrict what he could do. But it didn't entirely slow him down. Several years ago, he really needed a walker because he was a little unstable on his feet. But that didn't mean he had to slow down. And all the kids said, well, if you need any help around the place, there's lots of work. They'd either offer their husbands or spouses or themselves to come over and do the work. But Don still couldn't be nailed down. And one day I know Kath drove up, and there's his aluminum walker parked next to his aluminum ladder, and he's up cleaning the gutters. And Kath had words with him that day. Another time we came over to do the rototilling because we knew the garden needed rototilling, and I drive up and it's all done. It's been freshly done. So we have a conversation with Don, and it turned out he'd taken his walker out to the garage and somehow got this big rototiller started and then used the rototiller as a walker to go do the rototilling. You just couldn't nail him down. 2 years ago in February, Don had a really serious bout with pneumonia. And it put him in the hospital for over a week, and we really thought we were going to lose him. I mean, he was very, very, very ill. But Don was tough. And after about a week, he began coming back strong. And one day, Kath and Brenda were there visiting Don, and in comes the physical therapist, and she says, okay, Don, it's time to go for a walk. So gets him on the edge of the bed, puts the strap around his waist so she can hang on, and with Kath pushing the dolly with the IV drip and Brenda pulling the oxygen tank, the little quartet headed out to go down the hall. And they just get in the hall, and Don leans over to the therapist and says, have you heard the one about, and starts to tell her a joke. And she says, Don, let's get down to the waiting room and sit down. You focus on walking now. We'll tell the joke later. And sure enough, he remembered it. And when they got to the waiting area, sat down, and she told him the joke. I don't remember the joke, but I remember Cass saying that he's back. She knew he was back when his sense of humor returned. He was so tough that following that time, he was actually put under hospice care 3 times and thrown off twice because he just kept coming back. And I don't know many people that have had that experience. But that's the kind of guy he was. He was wiry and tough. And I know all of you that, and tough in a good way, not in a bad way. Well, I'm probably going to get the hook here, so let me close. But I want to close with the words of a country song, which I will not sing. But several years ago, there was a song that sort of stuck with me. And it says, it's not what you take when you leave the world behind. It's what you leave behind you when you go. And Don leaves a wife of 65 years, 5 kids that he was very proud of, had every reason to be, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, an extended family, tons of friends. And this place today is an example of the kinds of friendships that Don cultivated. But I think some of the best thing he left behind were just a boatload of memories. And I am confident that as people get together to tell Don stories and those memories get drawn out, that he's going to be warming hearts and bringing smiles to faces for many years to come.
Thanks, Steve. And thank you all for coming. As the youngest, it falls to me to tell a few stories and hopefully get everybody else started thinking about what they want to tell about. And I have to kind of disagree with Steve because we found out just a few years ago that Dad didn't really love gardening. And we were surprised. My wife asked, you must really love gardening. And he says, no, I don't. Well, why do you do it? Because she does, and he did it because he loved my mother. And, I thought about that for the last week, and I've been thinking and thinking, and all of us kids really knew our dad loved us, but he was not very expressive with that love. But we knew it by what he did for us. I recall a time when I was a skier. I loved to ski, and I had a ski lesson every Saturday, and I got on my bus in the morning and I got to the ski area, and later that day my dad drove all the way to Stevens Pass to pick me up and drive me all the way back to Garfield for a swim team meet. And, he just did it. You know, he would take me and my sister or take me and a friend to the ski area, and he would just wait there because he didn't ski, but he'd just take us there and do it. And, you know, we didn't really think anything of it at the time, but that's the way he was. He did so many things for people because he loved them, and it didn't matter what it was, he would step up and do it. I think Steve really got that right. He would step up and do whatever needed to be done because he loved the rest of us. And that was really a big thing for us all. He and I did a lot of canoeing when I was in high school. It was, he probably had just retired, and the canoeing started then. But after I was no longer canoeing with him, he canoed with Brenda and with Patty and eventually got Mom to go. And they went to Canada and they canoed up in the Bowron Lakes, which is a big, like a 75-mile loop through some lakes and rivers. And I remember one time canoeing, they were canoeing on the Winchester Wasteways. And Carol and I were sailing on Moses Lake expecting to meet them, and Larry was camped on one of the dunes with us, and he was hanging out, and a storm blew up. We were trapped out in the water because the wind died, and Larry saw water skis going end over end across the beach, and he goes, oh, I wonder where the guys are. And we were out trying to meet them. They got caught right near the lake by this storm because they were down in a little valley, and they pulled the canoes up and kind of hid underneath them and waited it out. And basically they waited it out till the next day, and you know, we were able to get back to our beach. And you know, he was probably the rock that everybody was depending on to keep them calm and keep them together, because he knew what he was doing. So, you know, he was just very, very special. And I think everybody here knows that. That's why you're here. So I think that's all I want to say. If anybody else wants to speak, we have a microphone. We can bring it around.
Thank you, Bruce. Is it on? Are you going to get it?
Wow. I knew Don was a well-loved man, but I didn't realize he was well-loved. I'll have to do some reading because I don't think I can do this without notes. For those who don't know me, I'm Dean Larson, Brenda's husband, Don's favorite daughter. Sorry, girls. That was the standing joke. Every time any daughter left, he always gave him a hug and said, you're my favorite daughter, or something to those words. So it was really good. I've known the Brown family since June of 2001 when I met Brenda. I introduced Brenda to my parents, our second date. I knew something was right. And then she did a turnaround, and a week later, she took me to meet her parents. Kathy and Steve, Patty and Mike were sitting down to dinner, and they asked us to join. And I said, no, we're okay. So, no, please sit down. No, we're okay. Sit down. So obviously you sit. Don was at the head of the table like he always is, and he's looking around at everybody. Pretty soon he kind of goes, everybody looks up, his fork's in mid-fork, as I call it, and he goes, we'll vote later. I guess it was unanimous, except for Bruce. He wasn't there, so he's still out in jury. Throughout the years, I've watched Don and all of the girls and Bruce, when Bruce would show up, because he lives in Colorado, that he truly loved all of his family, his grandkids, the kids, the great-grandkids. Just a wonderful person. I'm really privileged to have known him. He has several jokes that he would tell that I've been told if I told him, I'd be in trouble. So I can't tell some of those, but they're humorous. He had great sense of timing. About 3-4 months ago, Brenda and I were there, and I don't remember who else was there, but we're sitting there, and he's about ready to go to bed, and he came back out and sat down with us, and we're talking away, and he has two recent additions to the family, a couple of grandkids, great-grandkids, excuse me, And I spoke up and said, yeah, well, when I was in mom's womb for the first 3 months, she was sick for 3 months. And Don looks up and looks at me and says, I can see why. Then he goes, I shouldn't have said that. You know, he's just sitting there, and you don't realize that he's listening to what you're saying. And he'd come up with these little snippets like that, and we're just going, wow. You know, it's just, he was really a wonderful, wonderful man. And I'll give this mic over to someone else who wants to say something. And again, I thank all of you for showing your support for the Brown family.
I'll do like I usually do. Can you hear me? Can you see me? Thank you. I'm Don's older brother. I'm the last remnants of the older Brown tribe. I left home when I was about 16 because my father didn't believe in education. And I've been on my own ever since, even when I was married, my first wife. I was on my own, but she thought she took care of me. That was all right. I was accustomed to that. Anyway, Don joined me in Aberdeen, Washington at junior college. His first year, I ended my second year. The next year, we went to the University of Washington. And there's one thing I learned in those years with Don. I was bait for him. If I found a girlfriend and Don came around within 2 weeks, I was called Clyde, or Don. It took me a while to figure out what was going on. I learned as I went on through. When I had a girlfriend, I watched, and if she started looking at the taller boys, I knew I'd better move on because I wasn't going to be much. There wasn't anything there for me. My kid brother was the same way. Anyway, he was a lot of fun and a great guy. Don didn't study like I did in college. I'm not going to tell young kids what to do, when to do it or where to do it or anything like that. But Don was a socializer. I would be studying and he'd be shaking hands. And if you take our life together, I think he probably was more successful in many ways than I was. And yet I ended up with a 3.46 average, and he ended up with probably a 2.5. I don't know for sure. But anyway, he was more interested in talking to people than he was in studying books. We spent 4 years together. I got out just before the war ended, or before the war started. In fact, is I got out in 1939, he got out a year and a half later. He went to Kodiak. He was the head civilian there in the office, and he stayed with them after the war started because he never figured it out, but he had to go down in the morning and open the door, and then the Navy would move in, and if they'd look at the records and they couldn't figure out what it said, they'd have to ask him what it said, but they wouldn't let him have the records. He was a civilian. I understand that. I was in the Navy, too. Anyway, I want to tell you that he was one of the greatest guys I ever knew. Out of my other brothers, he was the only one that paid any attention to people. And when we were young kids, by this I mean married, we sat down and decided that we were going to not let our kids grow up and not know one another. We started a family reunion in the year of 1935. And we have not missed 1 year yet. Every year we've had a family reunion, and we're having one this year. And I think that's a remarkable feat for two families, and our kids know one another. I'm very proud of that. And I thank you very much.
Thank you, Clyde. If anyone else has a memory or anecdote that they would like to share, here we go. Would you stand, please?
When we moved to the Haller Lake community in 1964, Don and Phyllis were very gracious. They helped integrate us into the community, and they were just like second parents. And I just have to say that the two of them were the most wonderful, caring couple that you could ever imagine. I was just kind of reminiscing, hearing about the canoe trips. We did a lot of the canoe trips with them. We were on the Winchester in aluminum canoes in a lightning storm, and you couldn't ask for better companions on any trip at all. And he will be missed, and his wicked sense of humor also.
Anyone else?
Yeah, my name is Jim Chapman. My wife Carol and I are members of the Haller Lake United Methodist Church, where Don and Phyllis attended for many years, and Phyllis was the lead soloist in the choir. I have a couple of memories about Don and Phyllis. One is what generous hosts they were. We mentioned going to Hawaii. Well, of course, they had a condo there, and they would, when they weren't there, they would let the friends and other church members rent the condo. And so my family went over one time and used it. And let me tell you, I think they had the best location in Honolulu. If you've ever been there, you know what it's like. It's up about, I can't remember whether the 6th, 8th floor, something like that. And you're right on the edge of the tall buildings. And all you're doing is you're looking out north toward the pass and east to Diamond Head, the golf course, the Honolulu Zoo, and looking straight down to the end of the Alawai Canal, and you see the fish swimming in the canal right below you. And it was just a wonderful time. And also, as about that time, my wife was sick and in the hospital for a while, and so Don and Phyllis had us over for dinner, and we really appreciated that. The other thing that Don did that I think should be remembered was that he was one of the people that led the fight to keep the Metro bus base out of this area. If you remember back in the early 80s, Metro was looking for a north end place to house and repair and maintain their buses. And they were looking over toward Aurora, but it would impact the Haller Lake neighborhood. And we lived up in Lake Ballinger, and that was another place right across from the Holyrood Cemetery and looking straight down on Lake Ballinger that we felt would really have been a bad place. So the two neighborhoods, Don and Jan Kleppert, were led the Haller Lake area, and a man named Bob Boy and I were representing Lake Ballinger. And I hope between the bunch of us that we were able to persuade Metro to put the bus base where it is now and not in our neighborhoods.
All right, thank you.
I can think of a lot of things to say, but I'll keep it PC. I've known Don. I knew Don 48 years. I became a pretty good friend of Bruce's. Excuse me. When we were about six, and the thing I remember best is being welcome at his dinner table every night. I could do the dishes at my house and get to the dinner table at theirs in time to sit down for dinner. I could ride my bicycle pretty fast. So I live near the Haller Lake Grade School, and they were on the lake. So Don was a good dad to me, and when I was a troubled teen, my dad didn't know what to do with me and died when I was about 19. And Don was a good surrogate dad. And there's a lot of other stuff to say. Catch me when we're not in public.
Up there?
Sure.
Hello, can you hear me? I'm Joanne. I'm Brownie's daughter, Eulalie's daughter. In 1935, we went to Eastern Washington to go to the funeral of my dear Uncle Willard, who had died in an automobile crash. And Don and Glenn asked Mother if she could help them because they wanted to go to school. And so she said, I can take one of you, because she had been divorced and she was running this beauty shop working 6 days a week, 10, 12 hours a day in Montesano. And it was the Depression, and she said, I don't think I can take more than one. Well, both Don and Glenn showed up, and they did all of the work, helped around the house and everything. I can remember coming home from school, and Don was standing at the ironing board ironing my mother's clothes, and he had her bra on. I was alone with my mother, and I was very jealous of them. And they teased me, and it really helped me, you know, get used to the way the world is. But they did outrageous things. Don would say, well, now let's go do the dishes. And so we'd go in there, and then he'd walk out and leave me to do them. They would tease me and tease me, and then they would profusely apologize. They were awful. They would, at Thanksgiving, my mother was trying to teach these farm kids. She bought them suits, and she tried to teach them table manners. And they would tease her, and they would use the long arm reach with a fork to get the bread and this kind of thing. She tried to teach them how to carve the turkey at Thanksgiving and everything. And so my mother one time said, please pass the butter, dear. And one of my uncles passed the butter, and I said, she said, dear. And so anyway, they did me a lot of good with all that teasing and everything. And when I got married, which was not a great marriage, but anyway, when I got married, I was only 17, and Don said, meet us at the Olympic Hotel. And so we went there, and he bought champagne. And my mother said, isn't she too young to have champagne? He said, if she's old enough to get married, she's young enough to have champagne. Anyway, he's more like my brother than my uncle, and I loved him very much.
I am very grateful for this opportunity that I have to stand up and share my love to Tony and the family. I want to express my thanks and my appreciation to Don's children for allowing me and my team to work for his dad, for their dad. I know it's hard because I'm a new person. They did not know me, but my name is Milika, and I really appreciate your trust and all your love for me to share working with Tony Brown. I remember the first time, it's only almost 2 years that I worked for Don's Browns. And I know he's a very gentleman. Sometimes I'm working to him, but he wants to serve me. He wants to let me sit down on the table, and he wants to serve me, even I'm working to him. I really appreciate all his love. He is a father, he is a brother, and he is a teacher to me and my family. Thank you very much, Phyllis, for all your love and your children. And I know Brown's family, it's a family, it's getting together. And that's my testimony. And I want to leave all my love to all of you, and thanks in appreciation for all your trust to me and my team to work to your father. And I love you all.
Anyone else? Okay, back here.
Hello, Phyllis. This is Robert Bogatai. And I sang in the choir for Phyllis starting about age 10. And so I've known them for a few years. And when I grew up, Phyllis told me I was a little stinker when I was younger. And I never knew what she was talking about. But today I think I'm going to prove her right. So I've got two stories about Dawn. One, I see Phyllis nodding. Maybe she knows what I'm going to say. She probably does. At church, we had this session where during this service, people could stand up and share joys and concerns. And it was springtime, and the pussy willow tree was out across the church parking lot. And Dawn stands up and says, "How happy is it springtime the pussy willow tree is out there, because it's got the biggest pussies on it you ever saw." And I will never forget, I was sitting across from Phyllis in the choir, so I saw her face. I know what. The other story I will tell is, of course, the choir always had our summer picnic out at Phyllis's place. And they lived on Howler Lake, which meant they had a beach. And the beach had a name. And I don't know if anybody remembers the name of the beach. The name of the beach was Sonova. And if you say the two words together, okay, people are getting, I'm hearing snickers. So, okay, I won't say it, thank you.
I'm a neighbor of Dawn and Phyllis on Howler Lake. My favorite memory of Dawn is one New Year's Eve dance at the community club, when at the stroke of midnight, Dawn comes in dressed as old Father Time the last year, pushing a baby carriage with Harry Snyder as the New Year's baby. Now that was a classic, believe me. But I think that kind of indicates the impish nature of Dawn. And he was certainly a great neighbor, a great friend, and we're going to miss him.
Thank you. Anyone else? We'll also have an opportunity to gather afterwards and share stories with each other and remembrances. Anyone else like to say anything? Thank you. Steve?
Thank you.
I'd like to read a short poem from Mary Elizabeth Fry, which you can follow along, and it's also put in your program. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. I am a thousand winds that blow. I am the diamond glint on snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn rain. When you wake in the morning hush, I am the swift uplifting rush of quiet birds in circling flight. I am the soft starlight at night. Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not there. I do not sleep. You know, Don built a great life with the help of a lot of you. He provided for his family not only the necessities of life, but the wisdom, caring, and experience that have kept them together over the years. He and Phyllis sculpted a great landscape along Haller Lake, and they created memories that will last the lifetimes of his great-grandchildren and beyond that. And I'd like to conclude with a paragraph from Olive Schreiner's The Story of an African Farm that I think is appropriate in remembering Don this afternoon. And it goes, "When I lie down worn out, other men will stand young and fresh. By the steps that I have cut, they will climb. By the stairs I have built, they will mount. They will never know the name of the man who made them. At the clumsy work, they will laugh. When the stones roll, they will curse me. But they will mount, and on my work they will climb, and by my stair. And no man liveth unto himself, and no man dieth unto himself." Now, as we leave, may the memory of this fine man and the Spirit of God go with you and be with you in the days ahead. You're invited to remain for reception here and an opportunity to visit and share other memories. And again, thank you for being here and helping celebrate Don's life and to share the sadness and the happy memories with everyone else, with the family. I know they feel that way. So thank you for being here. Amen.